Hello, good morning and welcome. It's Thursday, the 31st, last day of October. I'm Alec Hogg and a really interesting program coming up for you. Headlined by Rob Hersoff, who wrote a piece called Why Capitalism Works and Socialism Doesn't. I know Rob was with us last week talking about a different subject that to do with sport and rugby in particular. We'll get an update from him there if there's been any development. But on this one, well, the business community loves Hersoff and they love the piece that he wrote. We're going to go into some depth with him on what he meant by it. And then if you recall, earlier this week, on Monday, in fact, we spoke with Makoni Maja from the Institute for Race Relations about the very important by-election results that came out last week. She referred us to the head of campaigns at the IRR, Marius Ruit, who had some very interesting insights to say that, on the one part, the AFF did not contest any of the by-elections, which is, well, the first time this has happened in many, many years. So it'll give us some insights into what's going on there. Marius will also unpack those by-election results for us. The DA holding on to a lot of their seats, and the Patriotic Alliance winning one from Good. And then yesterday was the mini budget or the medium term, whatever. And Kevin Lings is from Stanlib. He'll be bringing us some insights into that. He spent the day looking at the numbers. Thank you, Kevin. Saved me the job this year. Last night was very big night on Wall Street. We had what you'll hear later in the program. And there's something for everybody today. If you are an investor and you're invested in Microsoft, Meta, well, you would have been following early this morning what has come out from those companies. It was a quarterly results. They followed on the back of some very impressive quarterlies from Alphabet. And then last week we had Tesla still to come, Amazon, and then towards the end or middle of November, that's 21st of November, we will have the results from NVIDIA. And everyone's watching to see what the mega cap stocks, tech stocks, are doing relative to what's going to happen with NVIDIA, because they're the guys who benefit from the investments into AI, the capital investments. And there were some eye-watering numbers. We'll get more of that right towards the end of the program from our partners at Bloomberg. But there's also some insights in the news headlines. Here's Charlie Pellett of Bloomberg.
Vice President Kamala Harris says she strongly disagrees with comments made by President Biden that have been seized on by Republicans as insulting to Donald Trump's supporters, seeking to distance herself from a brewing controversy that threatens to undercut her momentum in the final week of campaigning. So what about the elections and U.S. markets, specifically bond yields? Emily Rowland is co-chief investment strategist at JH Investments.
It all comes down to the election, and we're kind of process of elimination investors. When we look at this backup in bond yields, we want to see, well, is it commodity-driven? Are we seeing inflation expectations increase? And in fact, there's a lot of signs of disinflation right now. We look at things like wage growth. That's gone from as high as 4% on average hourly earnings down to 2%. Initial claims still contain continuing claims, actually quite elevated. The quit rates come down. So the days, by the way, of leaving your job and finding another one to make more money, I think, are behind us.
Rowland was interviewed on Bloomberg Surveillance. Microsoft shares dropped in late trading after the software maker forecast slower quarterly cloud revenue growth, reflecting the company's struggle to bring data centers online fast enough to keep up with demand for artificial intelligence services. Here's Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella on the conference call.
All up, our AI business is on track to surpass an annual revenue run rate of $10 billion next quarter, which will make it the fastest business in our history to reach this milestone.
Also reporting after the close of trading, Meta Platforms and CEO Mark Zuckerberg will ramp up heavy investments in AI and other futuristic technologies, continuing a years-long tug of war between the company's long-term bets and the core advertising business that provides the vast majority of Meta's revenue. Reporting Thursday will be Amazon and Apple. As for the earnings backdrop and the broader market outlook, Keith Lerner is chief market strategist at Truist Financial.
We are in the middle of earnings, but the next 2 weeks is almost like a Super Bowl, right? We have the earnings, we have the employment report, we have the election, we have the FOMC meeting, we have China's stimulus news. So it's really going to be a jam-packed few weeks.
Lerner was interviewed on Bloomberg Open Interest. Volkswagen says it is seeking 10% pay cuts and other measures to shore up its struggling namesake brand while avoiding factory closures in Germany. And with that story, here's Bloomberg's Tom Busby.
Charlie, the carmaker's chief negotiator, presented the plan, which also includes a revised bonus system, after talks with labor leaders. Now, hours before the negotiations, Volkswagen reported its least profitable quarter in years, bolstering management's case for pursuing drastic measures in Germany. Unions have long resisted changes at the main VW brand, which has botched several electric vehicle launches and is struggling with low returns, slumping sales in China, and increasingly stiff competition in Europe, which has yet to return to pre-pandemic demand levels, have contributed to an earnings decline at the group. Charlie?
Bloomberg's Tom Busby reporting.
Well, capitalism in motion there, as you can hear. Volkswagen, who have a big operation in South Africa, for the first time closing down plants in Germany because they're just not doing well enough. Rob Herzhoff is a global entrepreneur, calling himself nowadays a capitalist activist. Hey, I like that, Rob. Second time in a couple of weeks that we've had you on the show. I'm going to talk about your column, which is being very well received by the BizNews community. But before we go there, you gave us some really good insight on the proposed Springbok Rugby deal with a private equity firm. Has there been any response to those discussions that we had here?
Yeah, I had a chat with Gayton one-on-one on the Sorry deal, and Gayton said to me, look, Rob, you know, it's not a perfect deal, but it's a deal. And, you know, if you think it's so bad, why don't you put up a better deal yourself? And he's right, you know, we should come to whomever is interested in competing with the Ackley deal should come to the table with a better deal. And I said, well, I'd sign the Ackley deal as it is right now. It's so good for Ackley and so weak for Saru. And then Gayton said, you know, and on the 15% commission, if Saru are stupid enough to sign a 15% commission, good luck for the guys who are getting the commission, which I suppose in some ways is true. But Saru is a national asset. The Springboks are a national asset. And it's not for amateurs like Mark Alexander and his team to give away the farm. There are so many smart people in South Africa that would have, you know, advised him for free. And I always say Investec and RMB, but, you know, there are tons of investment bankers in our midst, in the BizNews tribe, that I'm sure would spend a couple of days for free working with Mark Alexander to improve the deal with Ackley on behalf of the Springboks and behalf of Saru in South Africa. So it's just, you know, it's like kindergarten children up against wolves. That's what's happened. And Ackley did message me and said, I'm sorry, Rob, you don't like the deal. And I said, no, I think you guys have done an unbelievable job. You've rolled over Saru. I mean, Saru are babes in the woods compared to you. And he said, okay, noted. So, you know, do I want to make the effort to compete with Ackley on the deal? No, but there are much better entities than myself, global and South African, that should be stepping up, particularly some of the people who signed the union letter. So let's see what happens.
We wanted to talk to you this morning, nice and bright and early, and lovely to see the weather in Cape Town's spectacular.
It's
again.
Paternoster.
Paternoster. Where is that, Rob?
Paternoster is up the west coast, 2 hours from Cape Town. And Nick Ferguson and I have just done a very big real estate transaction on the coast quite near here, which we'll tell you about, you know, in a few months' time. But I came up here with my beloved wife, Katie, who's just gone for a run down the beach, to show her my new folly.
Aha. Uh-huh. Well, let's hope it's not a folly, Rob, and nice to see you investing in South Africa. So clearly the Western Cape. In the Western Cape. Okay. Capitalism. Capitalism works, socialism doesn't. You spent a bit of time thinking about that, and then you wrote a piece that we published yesterday with a fabulous cartoon, by the way, And the thrust of that is really to try and perhaps help with the education process, financial education process. And you go back to 1989, at which time the end of history. Capitalism won, socialism didn't. We saw what has happened subsequent to that. Socialism's made a huge comeback, maybe by those who don't have long memories. So you have to start the process, the education process, all over again, I presume.
100%. After the Second World War and after the Cold War, socialism had clearly failed. Socialism and communism were defunct, evil, destructive systems, and everybody knew it. And capitalism was the only way forward and a huge success. And it was just too clear to everyone. And here we are, you know, decades later, and young people still believe socialism hasn't been tried properly. And it's been leftist, communist and leftist propaganda that has infiltrated our institutions of learning, our universities and our schools, where teachers and professors are saying socialism hasn't been tried properly. And it's ludicrous. And about 4 years ago, I was walking through the V&A Waterfront Mall, and there was a Vodacom pop-up, you know, group of students wearing Vodacom shirts, handing out pamphlets and everything. And I walked up and I said, this is great. This is capitalism on display. And this one student said to me, female, she said, no, we don't believe in capitalism. I said, what? She said, well, socialism hasn't been tried properly. And I went, this is extraordinary. Where did you learn this? At UCT. And, you know, I mentor a number of young, mainly black, mainly males, who sort of ask, will you spend time mentoring me? And and it's not a scalable project, but I do take on people I like. And Jabu, you know Jabu. Mm. You know, he's like a younger brother now. And all of them have been told socialism hasn't been tried properly. And no one has read about The Invisible Hand. No one's read Adam Smith. You know, no one's actually spent the time, had the opportunity, or in school and university been given both options and shown the facts out in the outside world. And look at the facts are very simple. Cuba and Florida, they're, you know, a couple of hundred miles apart. Cuba had load shedding last week. Cuba's falling apart. Cuba is a socialist country. Florida is booming. East Germany and West Germany, Venezuela, you know, North Korea. I mean, you look at these countries that have adopted socialist policies where the government controls most economic decisions and almost all the property and assets in the country, failures. If you look at the happiness index of the country where people would most like to have been born, and the top 10, every single one of them is a capitalist country. The countries that have the innovation index, all of them are capitalist. All the facts show clearly capitalism works and socialism doesn't. And yet, people believe socialism hasn't been tried properly. It's devastating and it's terrifying.
But I guess it's also a challenge. It's a challenge to unwind a lot of the nonsense that certain people who grab hold of young minds can put into those minds. And I suppose if that's what you learned and that's what your university required you to write in your thesis, if you didn't, you would not get through it. You would not get past. And how does one, from your side, when you talk to a guy like Jabu or some of the others that you mentor, some of the other people you mentor, where do you start in explaining that perhaps the foundation of their knowledge is not on very strong strong grounds?
So when you go to children's, you know, younger children's school and you ask them what they want to do in life, what careers they want, they go fireman and pilot and, you know, nurse and whatever. It's all professional jobs because their little brains can understand that. But unfortunately, when you go to, you know, the broader population and say, who are your heroes? You know, what statues would you put up? It's generally politicians or regulators or people like that. It's not business people. But the greatest heroes on this planet are people like Elon Musk, Peter Thiel, Richard Branson, Rupert Murdoch, Johann Rupert. I can go on and on and on. Extraordinary business people who, in most cases, like Steve Jobs, from nothing, built extraordinary business empires. And they should be the people we build statues about. Now, I get it, you know, Winston Churchill, you know, saved Europe from us all speaking German or being burned in ovens. But there are business people that should have statues put about them who have created extraordinary things in our lives and changed our lives for the better. We need to start lauding, and BizNews does this, but broader than this, we need to start lauding and praising business people. Elon Musk, South African born, richest man in the world, one of the greatest entrepreneurs, has created Tesla, SpaceX, Starlink. That's a real hero, and we need to be promoting business heroes.
If you were to take the market value of just Tesla and you compare that with the South African economy, it would stagger people in South Africa that Tesla's worth more than all the money we spend in a year in this economy. So it's quite extraordinary. We're going to talk to Kevin Lings later about the latest. We're going to talk to a little bit later to Kevin Lings about the latest developments that we've seen on the mini budget. And I hope that we get some insights there from Kevin that the government is moving in a different direction. But Rob, we also saw this week that the Competition Commission has stepped in and has blocked Vodacom's proposed investment into a company called Massive. We also saw this week that it has blocked the proposed takeover by Sun International of Pyrmont Casinos. Pete Viljoen yesterday said this is because it's run by socialists. They don't actually understand capitalism. What's your take on that?
He's 100% right. If you look at SARU, these are all administrators. They're not business people. If you look at our cabinet, how many business people are there? Now, Gwede Mantashe pretends that he is a business person because for 8 years he worked embarrassingly at Anglovaal Mining, where he learned his mining practice. But he's a member of the Communist Party, a published member of the Communist Party. What a moron. I mean, how can you have a minister of mines who claims he's been in business, is still a member of the Communist Party? It's just muddled thinking at the highest level. And there are too many lawyers, too many regulators, too many bureaucrats, too many administrators, and not enough business people making decisions. You know, all my in-laws are lawyers in New Zealand. And I've launched Pacific Paddle, a paddle business in New Zealand. It's taken over a year, and we still don't have one court up yet. Now, we've signed some of the best leases in New Zealand, to the credit of our CEO there. He's been incredibly entrepreneurial. But you've got to get 20 different reports to build a paddle tennis court. It's not a 100-story building. It's a paddle tennis court. And New Zealand's overregulated. South Africa's overregulated. And unfortunately, what government attracts are regulators, lawyers, bureaucrats, not wealth creators. It's the wrong way around. I'd like to see way more business people like Elon Musk. If Trump wins, and I hope Trump wins, Elon Musk will be in charge of productivity and efficiency in government. I mean, isn't that a beautiful thing? And we need more of that. So we're on the back foot as capitalists, and we need to be back on the front foot again. We need to be promoting the fact that capitalism works and socialism doesn't, as widely as possible.
Rob, what are you hoping that the piece that you wrote for BizNews on this achieves?
Well, I hope it'll be posted as widely as possible. What I'd like to do is have more and more people, and there are people, you know, Martin van Staden, Ivo Vechter, yourself and others, there are qualified, smart journalists, intelligent people who are writing pieces like this. But we need to get into the universities and be lecturing these subjects to students, initially in the commerce departments, but more and more into the arts department, and debating these issues. You know, I would love to have a debate against Gwede Mantashe. I mean, he never shuts up, so someone would have to, you know, monitor the time. But I'd love to go head-to-head with him, even with Enoch, on this topic. But there are better qualified people than me, and they need to stand up and promote capitalism and tell the story to young people and not stop. It needs to be a daily, daily thing.
Open minds, no doubt. Rob Hirsoff, capitalist activist, thanks for your contribution today, as always. Rob is always happy to assist us and to guide us in the right direction. Well, we are going to now listen to another capitalist story. It's a company in the UK, their biggest tech company. It's called Arm, and it is the business that's got a lockhold on pretty much everything that is going on in the back end with the chips on phones. So let's pick up with our partners at the Financial Times on this story.
Arm is having a great year. Shares in the UK-based tech group have nearly tripled since it went public last September. And the company practically has a monopoly these days on the chip designs that power almost every cell phone. Now, Arm is thinking about getting into AI as well. But is it biting off more than it can chew? The FT's Tim Bradshaw has been considering this question, and he joins me now to talk about it. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Sonia.
So tell me about Arm's plans to expand its business model. What is the company looking to do?
Arm has built a very profitable business off the back of the smartphone. It's the chip designer behind Apple's processors in the iPhone and pretty much every other smartphone out there. But it has designs on expanding into other parts of the computing industry. The potential plan is largely coming from SoftBank, which bought Arm in 2016 and still owns about 90% of the company after it went public. SoftBank, which is this Japanese tech conglomerate led by Masayoshi Son, has huge ambitions to get into the AI space. They, according to our sources, want to build a big network of AI data centers in this new huge wave of investment that's going on right now.
Okay, so it sounds like Arm wants to kind of recreate the success it's had in phones with artificial intelligence. What sort of experience does the company have at the moment in AI?
Arm's technology already powers a lot of AI on the phones themselves, such as improving the quality of your photographs and things like that. But it's also forming a new role as the partner to NVIDIA, which is almost as dominant in AI chips as Arm is in smartphone designs. So when those two companies team up, NVIDIA makes the really powerful processor, the GPU, which handles training of artificial intelligence systems like ChatGPT. But then every computer needs a more general purpose chip that runs the whole computer. And that's primarily now based on Arm's technology. So Arm isn't necessarily in the driver's seat when it comes to AI workloads, but it is very much along for the ride.
How is Arm thinking about its relationship with NVIDIA then, if it's looking to dive headfirst into AI?
Arm doesn't make its own chips. It just sells designs for chips to Apple and Qualcomm and NVIDIA, who then turn them into their own processors. And if SoftBank's plan goes ahead in making Arm cross that Rubicon and actually start making its own chips in competition with its own customers, that's something that a lot of analysts and people in Silicon Valley think may just scare off Arm's biggest customers. So that's the tension, is Masa Son may want to make Arm into a competitor to NVIDIA, as well as trying to keep them as a partner. It's a delicate balance.
What do you think trying to maintain that delicate balance would mean for the chip industry more broadly?
At a time when all of the big tech companies are investing tens of billions of dollars in NVIDIA chips and the associated infrastructure that's needed to build ever larger AI systems, there is huge appetite for more providers of the AI chips that NVIDIA makes. The world is at the moment far too dependent on a single company for all of these AI processors. And so I think the fact that Masa Son is looking at this at all just reflects both how much anticipation there is that AI will just get an even bigger part of our lives, but also that everyone wants to get out from underneath NVIDIA's thumb.
Tim Bradshaw is the FT's global tech correspondent. Thanks, Tim.
Such an interesting story that if you listen to the details on the financial results that came out overnight, it was all about how is this going to affect NVIDIA? NVIDIA, a company that has grown from nothing, again, an example of Rob Herzog's story on capitalism. It's grown from nothing to be worth trillions of dollars because it invested ahead of the game in something nobody else wanted to invest in. Similar story with Amazon. They took the pain and now they're reaping the rewards. Maurice Ruert is head of campaigns at the Institute for Race Relations. Maurice, lovely to have you with us. Thank you for sharing with us your insights. And we had by-elections last week. They almost seem to just disappear and get forgotten. I keep a list of the by-elections. We've now had 287 since the November 2021 election. And that was the local government election. We don't have by-elections for national government. Well, you can perhaps tell us that. Why don't we? If an MP in national government were to resign, why don't we get the chance to actually find their successor?
For national and provincial elections, we have a pure proportional representation system where MPs and members of provincial legislatures are elected from party lists. So when a party, when we have our national elections and a party gets, say, 20 MPs, the people MP resigns or retires or passes away or gets kicked out of the party, then what happens is the next person on that list simply comes and replaces him. When it comes to local government elections, we have a mixed system where half our councillors are elected from wards, which are effectively constituencies, and then the other half are elected from similar kinds of lists that we get at national and provincial level. That's to ensure proportionality, because if we elected our various representatives just from geographical constituencies, we'd have some kind of, there'd be a disconnect between the proportion of vote that a party got and then their overall seat representation. I think what happened in the UK now is a very good example of that, where the Labour Party got over 60% of the seats in Westminster.
Let's go back to what happened on the 23rd of October. The DA had five wards that they won, but what was so interesting of this? There was a ward in Stellenbosch where they went from 85%, okay, pretty cool, that's high, to 98.6%. I mean, that's just like, it seems impossible that 98.6% of the people who went and voted for their local councillor went with DA. Pretty much across the board. There was one in Emalahleni where the previous amount was 60%. That went up to 88.5%, which is extraordinarily high. These are not exceptions. Looking through previous by-elections, it's almost like the DA faithful are coming out more and more now to support their party. There was one in J.B. Marks municipality, and I couldn't believe this. I had to double-check the number. On the 11th of September, where the DA's share of the vote in that ward was 99.2%, which sounds impossible to me, but there it is.
Yeah, when it comes to by-elections, it's also important, I think, to see what the local conditions were. So that the election in Stellenbosch, it was a very low turnout election. Only 4% of registered voters actually came out to vote. And I think that's because it's a lot of students in that area and was student holidays. So a lot of students weren't there. So I think you should take that one with a pinch of salt. The election in Emalahleni, as you said, the DA went from 60% to nearly 90%. But I think what was important there is that the Freedom Front Plus didn't run a candidate. And in the local government election in 2021, the Freedom Front Plus got nearly 20% of the vote. So obviously what happened in Emalahleni, I'd imagine that most of the Freedom Front Plus's supporters decided to vote for the DA in that election. I think when we look at that since 2021, and especially since the May election, some other parties, especially the Patriotic Alliance, seems to be doing not too badly. And the ANC, as has been the case, outside of KwaZulu-Natal and outside of most of the cities, the ANC support is also pretty steady. So I think that's what you got to do when you look at by-elections. You need to look at it holistically and see what the trend is. So yeah, as I say, I think it's important to look at this, from a kind of bird's eye view, but these trends are important to look at, I think.
It's not often that the Patriotic Alliance actually wins these wards, or not often since the November 2021. Do you want to just take us through the story there in George?
In the local Gums election, it was actually a ward that was won by the Good Party, but it was quite a marginal ward. A Good won it with 27% of the vote. Patriotic Alliance in that election actually didn't even get 1%. They got 16 votes in total, which came to 0.9%. Then a by-election was held there last year. The Patriotic Alliance saw its support go from less than 1% to nearly 26%, which was actually enough for it to win that ward. That's because the vote was split between the ANC, the DA, and a local party called the Plaaslike Besorgde Inwoners. Each of those parties got just over 20%. But the PA managed to, they came out of the single biggest party with nearly 26%. And then there was another by-election because the PA, a guy who had been elected there, he actually defected to the DA. But in now in the by-election that was held just a couple of days ago, the PA actually saw its support go up to over 50%. So it went from getting only 16 votes in the local Gums election, that particular ward, to getting nearly 1,500. In the by-election that was held now a few weeks ago. So there's definitely something going on with the Patriotic Alliance. Another ward there where I think the Patriotic Alliance did well, which is also worth pointing out, is in there's the same set of by-elections now, just the last week on the 23rd of October, in Musu Kaligwa, which is Ermelo. Patriotic Alliance, they didn't win, the DA won that ward, but they managed to get 27% of the vote. They were the second biggest party in that ward. And I think what's interesting is that before that, the PA didn't even field the candidates in the local Gums elections in that municipality. They didn't even think it was field the candidate because they didn't think they really had the support. But now in this by-election, they got 27% of the vote. Look, it was a low turnout by-election. Only 20% of people came out to vote. So it translated to 180 votes for the Patriotic Alliance. But I think it's quite telling that the PA is doing well also in areas because this is in Ermelo, so it's obviously not a place where you get too many coloured people staying. And generally, we think of the PA as kind of a coloured interest party, but it's obviously doing pretty well in places where you don't get too many coloured people. So I think Gayton McKenzie's message is obviously starting to resonate with people. And we also recently saw polling that came out from the Social Research Foundation. The PA's polling is looking pretty good. I think the Social Research Foundation had them at around about 4 or 5% in its most recent polling.
From 2%,
so I think it's
from around 2% in the election.
Yeah, 2% in the exactly. So obviously, people are liking what Gayton McKenzie is doing and the kind of messages putting forward. I think
that switch of the councillor from the PA to the DA, and then the voters saying, "Okay, well, we don't like you. We actually prefer the party more." Must be sending messages to the Democratic Alliance.
Yeah, I think, as I was saying, I'm not sure if your listeners heard because it was breaking up, but I think it's also important to see the kind of dynamics in a local ward or in a by-election or whatever the case is. So it might have been that the person the new candidate for the PA was maybe a well-known local community activist or, you know, somebody who's got pretty good name recognition. So I think it's important to look at these kind of issues holistically. And I think the DAs will have to see how it's been doing in other places where, you know, it's been going up against the PA. And look, it hasn't all been completely plain sailing for the PA. Since the May election, it has actually lost two wards to the DA. One was in Beaufort West, and not the other place. I can't remember exactly where the other one was. So, you know, it's not exactly like the PA is this juggernaut where it's winning just all these DA wards. It's all pretty complicated and complex. And as I say, there's lots of local dynamics that happens in ward elections and local by-elections that you've got to keep a lookout for. But as I say, you've got to look at the overall trend, and that kind of starts giving you the direction of travel, I think.
On Monday, Makoni said that you, in conversation with her, said there was something quite relevant about those by-elections last week and the EFF.
Or not just last week. So since the May national election, there have been 78 by-elections in total. And what was interesting is that the EFF has only stood candidates in 43 of those by-elections, so just over 50%. But what's relevant about that is since the local government elections in 2021, up until the May elections, there were about 220 by-elections since the local government elections up until the May general election. And the EFF stood candidates in every single by-election, even in places where they didn't even have a snowball's chance. I mean, there was an election in Middelburg, in the Steve Tshwete municipality in Mpumalanga last year in June, where the EFF candidate, he didn't get a single vote. He literally got zero votes. So the EFF was standing candidates all over in places where they absolutely didn't have a chance. You know, they'd stand candidates in Sea Point or in Bryanston in Johannesburg or something, places where they really had no chance whatsoever. And since the May elections, they seem to have changed their strategy. In last week's local government elections, they didn't stand any candidates whatsoever. So there's either a change in strategy in the EFF where they've decided it's a waste of resources to stand candidates in every single by-election. No other political party does that. Even the ANC has stood out hasn't run in every single by-election. It runs in most by-elections, even in places where it doesn't have a chance, but every now and again it decides to take a step back. The DA doesn't do that. The DA only stands in by-elections where it's got a pretty good chance of winning the ward. So I think it's quite interesting that the EFF has changed the strategy, and you've got to ask why. Has it changed the strategy because it's actually deciding to do things differently, or are there problems within that party? Are there financial problems, or are they struggling to get candidates to stand for them? And I think it's all linked to what's been happening with the EFF since the May elections, where I think they had a pretty disappointing election, especially in KwaZulu-Natal, where they only got 2% of the vote. And we've already seen, I mean, a second most prominent person, Floyd Shivambu, has defected from the party to go to MK. And we've all seen people like Busisiwe Mkhwebane and a couple of other people who've left the EFF or MK. So I wonder if this is symptomatic of some other more serious problems within the party. So it's definitely something, I think, to keep a watch out in the future.
Marius Ruert, and thanks for persevering with us, Marius. He is with the Institute for Race Relations, campaign manager. Well, yesterday was a big day. Usually I spend the mini budget in lockup, get there to Cape Town at 6 a.m., which means a very early start for me. And this year I thought, let's rather just rely on Kevin Lings. And Kevin Lings is the chief economist of Stanlib, joins us now. Kevin, were you in lockup yesterday?
No, I didn't go to the lockup. I had too many other things on in the morning, so I couldn't make that. But, they released the documents immediately that the minister starts to speak, so you get all the information fairly quickly. Also, I must say the media does a good job in encapsulating what the minister has put out. So it doesn't take you too long to sort of catch up with what the main issues are and then spend some time delving into the minute detail.
Yeah, the stuff that the context that you would see that perhaps when I was sitting there for 6 hours and just regurgitating, it was very difficult to understand. So this is a better way of doing it. What were the highlights of Enoch Godongwana's address yesterday? I've also read a lot about it, and there are various themes that are coming through quite strongly, but I value your opinion.
So, Alec, I think that overall you would say a bit disappointing. I think there were expectations by a number of market participants that you would get a much more upbeat tone, that you would get a much more vibrant set of initiatives to lift the growth rate more fully. And you just didn't get that. So I think a couple of things stood out here. One is, if you think about it, over the next 3 years, the minister still doesn't have GDP growth going above 2%. So he's saying, yes, next year it grows at 1.7% thereabouts, and we had 1.1% this year. So you could say, yes, the economy is projected to get stronger. But 1.7%, it's not going to do it. You need to get the growth rates up at about 3% and higher, and then sustain it there. in order to make a difference to the labor market, which is in essence what this is all about, because if you can create particularly formal sector jobs, a hell of a lot changes, particularly for the government, changes in terms of the tax base, and the tax base broadens out, and then they can achieve so much more. But if you look at what the minister's saying, that is over the next 3 years, we get to 1.9% growth. That's with the world economy picking up. That's with inflation under control. That's with interest rates being cut. That is with an infrastructure stimulus, 1.9%. To me, that was the disappointment, that the minister's recognizing that this is all going to take a significant period of time, and that, yes, the initiatives, I think, are appropriate. The initiatives being primarily private-public partnerships in key infrastructure areas. I absolutely agree with that. I think that's our only alternative to try and grow this economy. But there's no doubt that those initiatives are going to take a number of years to really lift the growth rate meaningfully. The other thing that stood out here is that the fiscal slippage continues. Now, it's not...
What's that, it's Kevin? What is fiscal slippage?
The fiscal slippage is that you set a range of parameters in the February budget, and then 6 months later, which is now, you have to say, well, we're not quite meeting those budget objectives. It's like a company setting a profit, you know, objective, and then it has to own up and say, we're not quite there. So what is slipping is tax revenue underperforming, not massively, but 22 billion is 22 billion. Mm. And so there's a revenue loss projected now relative to what we projected of 22 billion. There's a expenditure overrun of in the order of 10 or so billion, not massive, but the combination just moves you in the wrong direction. Whereas what you keep hoping is that this thing is all going to start to look quite a bit better. You keep hoping that the credit rating agencies will have something more tangible to look at to say, okay, we'll give you a positive outlook. And so the fiscal slippage, it just continues on. And it's probably unavoidable. There are key reasons why that's happened. But it highlights this essence of it, that without economic growth, this will continue to happen. There's no substitute. You can't budget your way away from low economic growth. You just have to grow this economy a lot faster. And then thirdly, the debt level is going up. So the debt level is going to go to over 75% of GDP. Now, I keep reminding people, but I think it's important. In 2009, when Trevor Manuel left as Minister of Finance, our debt level was 23% of GDP. So we've gone from 23% to now 75% of GDP, which happens, right? It happens in a lot of countries. The problem for South Africa is, what did we achieve through that massive increase in debt? What have we got to show? If you look around in society, if you look at healthcare, if you look at the roads, if you look at infrastructure, what have you got to show for that massive deterioration in your fiscal balances? And the answer is very, very little. You've got a huge labor force, which the minister, I thought he did a very good job in highlighting just how many people the government employs. And if people have got time, I would go look at some of that data that the minister has provided. We employ a lot of people relative to many, many other countries, including developed economies. And so we're spending a lot of money on labor. We're spending a lot of money on the debt level itself in terms of the interest cost. And so there's very little to do anything else. So all of that is a little bit depressing. Where the focus is, though, is where the encouraging bit is, and that is to try and move the infrastructure initiative forward, to try and get the private sector into the system more fully, drive public-private partnerships, and Transnet is critical. Transnet is in a bit of a holding pattern at the moment in terms of, if you read the medium-term budget, there's not a lot that was said about SOEs. And part of that is that Transnet put out their network statement a while ago, early this year, for public comment. And they need to finalize that. The network statement is, in essence, an invitation to the private sector to do business. And when that document comes out in its final form, we'll have a lot more information on exactly the type of parameters that Transnet wants to work towards. And then we can judge whether the private sector will be interested in running various rail corridors. That document is expected out before the end of this year, so not far away, right? So up until we get that and we can understand where the private sector is going to get involved, how extensively Transnet wants to use the private sector, that initiative is in a bit of limbo. And it's a critical initiative. So you've got Eskom and Transnet doing the heavy lifting in terms of some of this infrastructure development. And the idea is that if you can do that, if you can draw in the private sector more and more, and the private sector, I must say, is very willing. I've been in a lot of discussions with pension funds, with various pools of investment funds. The private sector is more than willing to get involved. But you've got to free up the system more fully to get that private sector involved. They're not simply going to hand over money and not be comfortable that there's going to be corruption or maladministration. So it feels to me, from that perspective, yes, more positive. The last sort of comment is there's an improved sentiment in South Africa that is reflected in a range of things. The currency, equity markets, the bond market, a lot of CEOs of companies have an improved sentiment story they talk about, right? And that is vital. Now, at this stage, it's not a lot more than sentiment. And some of that sentiment has come about because of electricity being better, some of it because of the government of national unity. There are a range of good reasons why the sentiment is better, right? But it feels to me that you've got to use that opportunity wisely. You've got to build on it quite quickly. Sentiment is a way of disappearing if you don't nurture it. And if you don't, if we lose this opportunity where people are more encouraged, people are more optimistic, they feel the economy should be doing better, and we don't create enough initiatives, then I fear that this time next year we'll be saying, oh, we're not really moving, things are a bit lackluster. So you've got this conflict. It's very clear that the infrastructure initiative and government's initiative are going to take time, but it's also very clear that you don't have time. And so you hope that government recognizes the urgency with which some of these things need to be looked at. And you need another win. You need something that captures people's imagination that says, yes, we're moving this thing forward. It does feel better. So the numbers are not great in the medium-term budget. The initiative, the policy is correct. The time frames, we don't have the luxury of time. So I would want to see more urgency come through.
You're on fire, Kevin. I didn't want to interrupt you while you were rolling there, but that's really good stuff. I guess the big issue for investors, and Stanlib is an investment company, so you, the guy who gives the portfolio managers the steers of what's happening, is this going to be another Ramaphosa blip for South Africa's equities, or is the government of national unity blip that we've had so far going to be sustainable? Because what you've said now is, and what we've picked up from the mini budget is it is looking more like we might just have another damn squib.
So that is genuinely a real risk. Now there's a lot of people wanting this to work in various parts of various market participants, various companies, CEOs. I must say the focus to get this to the economy to do better is broad. And that's not something I would easily dismiss. When I've chatted to CEOs recently, they all express a significant improvement in confidence. But what they don't say is when I say, okay, so are you going to be investing? Are you going to be expanding? You've got a decent balance sheet. You could take on a bit more debt if you wanted to. Are you about to expand, build capacity, employ more people? And they all say, every one of them, no. We're not at that point yet. And that's the missing ingredient. And you've got to translate the confidence into action. Now, I think the sentiment will continue on. I don't think it's that fickle. I don't think it will quickly and just suddenly disappear. I think any of that is going to be really the issue. So you would imagine that the sentiment can continue on well into next year. And I think that if during the course of next year you can implement a policy that moves the country into a better space, then I think you can unlock that sentiment in a better way. Companies have underinvested for a huge period of time. They've got backlogs in terms of technology upgrades. It's off a low base. There's a lot that companies need to do. So I think it can last. I don't think it lasts unattended. By that I mean you're going to have to add to it, actively work on it if you're government. And so there is a good chance that Ramaphosa gains momentum, but you can't bet on it yet. So I know that's a fairly vague answer, but that's more or less where we are. One of the things, Alec, that comes back to us is companies say this, a lot of companies say this. They say they're worried about succession. So if you've got a company that is thinking about investing, they're more confident, they're thinking about expanding, that expansion might be a multi-year expansion. They want to know that there's succession beyond Cyril's term. And what does that succession look like for business? And we've got no real clarity on that at this stage.
Yeah, we've got four candidates on the ANC side. We don't know what the ANC is going to get in the next election. Boy, there's a complicated area, but that's why we're so grateful to have Kevin Lings giving us his insights and honest as always. Kevin, thank you for joining us this morning. And as promised, now let's get those Microsoft results from our partners at Bloomberg.
An earnings palooza, looking at shares of Meta Platforms right now. They are lower in the after hours, but not by much. They were bouncing around a little bit, but now down about 1.1%. We got news that the company sees fourth quarter revenue coming pretty much in line with estimates, $45 billion to $48 billion. Mark Zuckerberg himself calling it a pretty good quarter, a good quarter, in the press release. Let's see what Mandeep Singh has to say about that. Mandeep joins us here in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studio. He's Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Technology Analyst. He's looking at these numbers. What sticks out to you, especially in the wake of what we heard yesterday from Alphabet?
Yeah, I think most of the numbers that I see are in line with expectations. I mean, the one thing is ad pricing. So ad pricing continues to tick up. If you look at this quarter, I think it was around 11%. Impressions went down a little bit. And it's just a function of how well they have been executing in terms of, you know, implementing generative AI and really making changes that compared to Snap, who reported yesterday, we saw Snap's ad pricing decline. So, you know, that just goes to show at what scale
they are. Can we really compare the two?
Well, I mean, digital ads is a function of how much you are better in terms of targeting versus the other platforms. So Google search ad pricing grew 7%. Meta Platforms ad pricing grew 11%. Mm-hmm. Snap ad pricing down 7%. So it just goes to show it's easy to monetize on Snap, but you are not getting the ROI. In the case of Google and Meta, you are getting an ROI on your ad spend, and that's why advertisers are willing to spend more. So it's a function of scale, but the effectiveness is there, and that's evident in Meta Platforms.
Okay. Business.
Yeah.
I want to talk about all the kooky things that they're still spending money on. Reality Labs posting a $4.4 billion loss in the third quarter. Its revenue did rise 29% year over year to $270 million in the third quarter. That was actually below analyst expectations. $4.4 billion. What are they doing over at Reality Labs?
I mean, we know it's the investments in the VR headsets, the Ray-Ban glasses we have talked about at length. And look, I think... they will always be a drag on the overall operating profit, because even if they sell, you know, hundreds, thousands, millions of these, the margins will never be comparable to their core ads business, which is north of 50%. So hardware is a money-losing business for Meta right now, and that's what's evident in that $4.4 billion loss.
One of the headlines coming out of these numbers, Meta still sees significant capital expenditures growth in 2025. I feel like I'm talking to someone right now about the Federal Reserve minutes. What is, quote, significant mean here?
Help us.
Well, so look at how much the CapEx grew in 2024 so far. And we are talking about already, you know, a 20% bump. In the case of Microsoft, it's 50%. So significant could be 50% from, you know, $40 billion this year. And that would get it closer to $60 billion. Now, the difference between Meta and Microsoft is the CapEx intensity for Meta is already north of 20%. Normally for large tech companies, CapEx intensity is like 10 to 15%. That's where Alphabet is at.
So where are they spending this money? Katie mentioned that about 10% of NVIDIA's revenue comes from Meta platforms, about 20% coming from Microsoft.
Yeah.
Where does Meta spend this money next year?
It's going towards GPUs. I mean, it's every large tech company right now is looking to build bigger data centers where they can train their AI. And Meta has that distinction of owning a large language model, their Llama language model, which they didn't mention a lot in the release, but it will come up on the call. And they have talked about Meta AI having 500 million monthly active users. That is powered by Llama. In fact, there was some talk about Llama being licensed to an Amazon AWS. So they could start monetizing that. I mean, there's no mention of it in the press release, but we will hear about that on the earnings call.
I want to talk a little bit about the share reaction. Meta share is currently down over 3% right now, but I mean, it's been an incredible run for Meta. You talk about price to perfection. I don't know if perfection exactly was priced in, but the bar was certainly high for this stock.
And look at the multiple. The price to earnings multiple of Meta is 25 times forward earnings compared to an Alphabet, which is still below 20 times forward earnings. So clearly, there is that gap that Alphabet could catch up to these guys in terms of multiples, and Microsoft is close to 30 times earnings. So when, you know, the setup is such that expectations are higher, I mean, Microsoft had 34% growth in Azure. Still, that wasn't good enough to drive up the stock. So that's where expectations come into play.
Can you mention Llama and a potential integration. Explain to everyone what Llama is and how Meta Platforms is actually using it outside of sort of internally. I mean, I know, I don't know, am I seeing Llama when I go search on Instagram, when I search on WhatsApp?
Yeah, so
is that Llama?
We've started hearing about Meta getting into their own search business.
Yeah.
And look, Google and Meta have that distinction of owning their large language model, whereas everyone else is dependent on OpenAI or Anthropic, which are independent companies. So in the case of Meta, they've had a lot of success. It's like Llama is on 3.2 release, and every release is getting better in terms of the native capabilities.
But can I download Llama as a standalone app right now?
No. So this is a
like
large...
I can't download it like I download ChatGPT and use ChatGPT.
I mean, they're looking to go towards that model where you can use Llama in that form, but right now Llama is just being deployed across their family of apps, which is Instagram, you know, WhatsApp, and Core Blue app. Again, owning a large language model is such a huge moat, and that's where, you know, all these companies spending on data centers, the compute capacity, what they're looking to do is to really build on that large language model moat.
There you go.
There you go. Mandeep, we should let him get back to work.
He's got
a call to listen to. He's got a report to write. He's busy after Alphabet and Snap yesterday. We made him talk about Reddit. He didn't even know he was going to talk about Reddit yesterday. We made you go everywhere. Mandeep, thanks so much for joining us. Really do appreciate it. Okay, so Meta Platform shares moving in the after hours. They were down as much as 3%, now down about 2.7%. Katie, help me out with Microsoft and what Microsoft is doing.
I mean, I think it comes back to those high expectations as well. You see shares right now. It was a pretty clean quarter overall, and I can't seem to quite get off the ground in the after hours trade. We've been toggling around, 34 times earnings? That's what it's trading at. That's a pretty high bar, Tim.
Yeah, it is. Microsoft Cloud's computing business, the Office software, fueled stronger than expected quarterly revenue growth. It's a sign that the company's heavy investments in AI are starting to pay off.
And that brings us to the end of today's Biz News Briefing. Look forward to being back in your company again tomorrow at 7 a.m. We do open the back end, so you can join us live in the studio. I think the guys who were live today saw some interesting things happening and just tells you that when you make the sausage, it doesn't go as smoothly as it might appear to those outside of the factory. Thanks for being with us from our technical producer, Ruan Erasmus, executive producer, Lucy Ferreira, and yours truly, Alec Hogg. It's been our pleasure. Please join Lucy tonight for News Wrap. That's at 6 o'clock on the Biz News TV channel on YouTube. Till tomorrow, cheerio.